Welcome to Tooled Up Education's Researcher of the Month, where the Tooled Up team selects a paper from a notable researcher that will be of interest to parents and school staff everywhere.
Kimi Mori completed her Bachelor of Psychology and Bachelor of Dance in 2018 and a Master's in Clinical Psychology she achieved in 2020. She is currently a PhD candidate conducting research in the Determinants of Child Development Lab, which is housed within the Clinical Psychology Programme at the University of Calgary. The focus of Kimi's dissertation has been on problematic sexual behaviours, or PSB for short, in children. Specifically, she has studied the association between exposure to sexual content and PSB, as well as characteristics and outcomes of a treatment group for children with PSB and their families.
Okay, Kimi, welcome. Thank you so much for joining us today. We've made you our Researcher of the Month after a publication of a new paper which reviews the existing literature on the relationship between exposure to sexual content and problematic sexual behaviours in children and teens, with the aim of establishing a better and more unified understanding of the association between the two. First of all, congratulations on a new paper getting published. Always a hard job in the academic sphere, so well done on that. But in the paper, it outlines that children might typically display a range of sexualized behaviors as they start to grow up, and it's nothing really to worry about. So I wondered if you could firstly talk us through what developmentally is typical behaviors that we might see in children and teens of different ages, and what those behaviors tend to look like.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much. And for sure, so as you said, children do often display sexualized behaviors that are a normal part of development and that aren't any cause for concern. So for preschool age children, it's really normal to be curious about their own and others' bodies. This might look like a child looking at others' bodies, engaging in sexual play, which might involve showing their body parts or looking or briefly touching the body parts of other children out of interest or curiosity. Children might also touch their sexual body parts alone or in public. And the National Center on the Sexual Behavior of Youth draws a really helpful parallel here when they say that you can think of sexual self-touch in this age range as similar to when a young child, say, sucks their thumb or cuddles with a soft blanket. These are sensory experiences that don't involve sexual fantasy, but are soothing and that feel good. In school-age children, so about 6 to 12 years of age, they start to gain an increased sense of privacy about their bodies, curiosity about their own and others' bodies, and about sexual relationships. So it's not uncommon to be using sexual language or engaging in consensual kissing, hugging, or holding hands. And then in the adolescent period, so this is about 13 to 17 years of age, some sexually exploratory behaviors are perfectly normal, for example, masturbation or consensual sexual relationships with developmentally similar peers.
Brilliant. And that's really interesting to know, actually, that it's really across the age range. So starting as, like you say, as young as preschool and going all the way up to adolescence. So that's super, very interesting. Thank you. And so those are the behaviours that you've outlined are very developmentally typical. And as you've kind of continually said, which I think is good to stress, these are normal, not cause for concern, things that we typically see. So is there a standard definition of problematic sexual behaviour? And could you talk us through what distinguishes problematic behaviour to typical behaviour? And again, maybe outline in different age groups what those look like.
Definitely. So problematic sexual behavior, or PSB for short, is generally defined as developmentally inappropriate sexual behaviors that are potentially harmful to oneself or others. So there are a few key things that can help distinguish between normal sexual behaviors and ones that would be considered problematic. So if sexual behaviors are at all aggressive or coercive or cause harm or distress, then that would be problematic. If the behaviors are initiated with strong negative emotions, such as anxiety or anger, or are between children of markedly different ages, so wouldn't be considered developmental peers, that would also be considered problematic and cause for concern. And behaviors are more likely to be problematic if they're persistent, if they're planned as opposed to spontaneous, and if they don't respond to adult interventions, such as parenting strategies. In terms of what these behaviors might look like in different age ranges, in preschool age children, it could look like behaviors that are really preoccupying or forceful or persistent attempts to, say, look at or touch themselves or others' body part. In school age children, problematic behaviors could be things such as asking persistent, repeated questions about sexuality, sexual behaviors involving much younger children, aggressive behavior that's sexual in nature, touching oneself in public. And in adolescence, behaviors that are aggressive, coercive, non-consensual in any way, or again, that involve much younger children and would be considered problematic.
Excellent, thank you. And how common are those types of problematic sexual behaviors?
Mm-hmm. Because sexual behaviors generally and particularly in children can be met with a lot of stigma or embarrassment, they aren't always talked about or reported, which can make it really hard to get sort of an accurate sense of how often this behavior occurs. However, child advocacy centers in the US, these are places that are set up to support children who have experienced abuse. About 20 to 25% of child sexual abuse cases involve a child having acted towards another child, which does suggest that PSB occurs a non-trivial amount.
Yeah, that's quite actually more. I wasn't expecting that percentage when you said it. But like you say, it might be a little bit more or less depending on how often it's reported. Because I remember, like, even when I was younger and even seeing friends who have children now, like you say, it's sometimes maybe a bit embarrassing when it's a normal exploratory behavior, but especially in public, the parent is always like, don't do that, stop doing that.
Absolutely.
But no, that's good to distinguish between what is normal and, as you say, the kind of more problematic side we're looking for, that aggressive or coercive behavior or kind of those negative emotions being associated with that as well. That's perfect. Thank you so much. And you've recently published a meta-analysis of the available literature in this area. And can you tell us a little bit about why you decided to write this paper and what you hope to establish with the analysis?
Absolutely. So the decision to conduct this study arose from a want to better understand what contributes to this behavior. So the study specifically is looking at the link between exposure to sexual content, such as pornography, and problematic sexual behavior. And the reasons we looked at exposure to sexual content are because, one, we saw that among children who were referred to treatment for their sexual behaviors, there were often reports of them having been exposed to sexualized content. Mm. And while it sort of intuitively makes sense that watching pornography might lead to problem sexual behavior, we wanted to see what conclusions could be drawn when we actually look at the data as a whole. And then also we wanted to look at exposure to content because access to personal devices, access to the internet has just become commonplace among children. And therefore it's important to understand what the implications of that access might be on this particular kind of behavior. Because a meta-analysis is essentially a statistical summary of existing research, what we wanted to establish was whether or not that link between content exposure and PSB exists based on the research that's available to date.
Excellent. And what did you find in that analysis?
So we found that exposure to content is linked with an increased likelihood of engaging in PSB. And we found that there was a difference with regard to violent and nonviolent sexual content. However, that difference wasn't significant. So generally, overall exposure tends to increase likelihood is what we found.
Excellent. Thank you. No, that's good to know. And I know you just touched on it there a little bit about kind of access to devices, and especially in this day and age, that's becoming a lot more common, and younger children I'm seeing have phones or access to other devices now. And we know that obviously from your meta-analysis that actually there is a link then between viewing or exposure to sexualized content and problematic sexual behavior. And we know that, you know, children are curious or might be shown things. So phone ownership means that children can view pornography or other sexualized content quite easily. And in the UK, there's been a couple of government commissioned reports by the Children's Commissioner into the use of pornography by children and young people. One of those reports states that young people, in unequivocal terms, have said that harmful behaviour is directly influenced by violent pornography. And actually, then that seems to be quite in line with what your meta-analysis showed between the relationship and that kind of, I suppose, more you were saying sexualized content, but is there other content as well that might influence that behaviour or influence problematic sexual behaviour?
Yeah, exposure to things like live sexual content as well. So being exposed to, say, if you walk in on your parents having sex, sometimes exposure like that can also impact these behaviors. With regard to, you know, the Children's Commissioner and that statement about, in unequivocal terms, that harmful behavior is directly influenced by pornography, it is important to make the note, though, that our study doesn't show that there is a direct one-to-one relationship between the two. there's a lot of still many unknowns about what contributes to this association. Mm-hmm. And we also know that not all children who have been exposed to sexual content go on to exhibit PSB at all. So just to make sure that it's clear that it's not a direct one-to-one relationship.
Mm-hmm. No, that's perfect. No, that, I think that, again, that's something important for parents and other people, educators, schools, to know that it isn't that kind of direct one-to-one links. And actually, yeah, you just said there that there are some people that are exposed to that sexualized content, but actually don't then go on to develop or show problematic sexual behavior. And has there been any research around, I suppose I'm thinking more in a psychology term, like risk and protective factors around kind of viewing sexualized content and then going on to or not going on to display problematic sexual behavior?
Yeah, definitely. So in terms of things like risk protective factors, well, protective factors, these can include things like in supporting healthy boundaries, decision making, supervising children. So lack of supervision can be a risk factor. Protective factors can be having open conversations about emotions and how to manage them in healthy ways. Because as I mentioned, sometimes these behaviors emerge as a way to cope with difficult emotions. Sure. So for example, normalizing curiosity, supporting children in understanding what's appropriate and inappropriate behavior, helping them come up with ways to cope with things like anxiety and stress. And also providing children with accurate information about their bodies is also protective.
Perfect. You know, I actually was thinking about that as well, because I think not everyone, but there is sometimes, like you say, that just that bit of embarrassment about talking about your body and about different body parts and what they do. And I think even with the best intentions in the world, parents maybe will avoid using appropriate vernacular or will have like try and think of euphemisms or metaphors for different things, which I can imagine, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, might cause a little bit of confusion. Obviously, age-appropriate conversation needs to be had, but like you say, it's maybe actually using appropriate terms for your body and functions actually could be helpful rather than causing more confusion.
Definitely. And it could look like even, you know, with a peer, partner, or spouse or whatever, practicing using those terms before having that conversation with children can help to just make it feel a bit more comfortable, more natural.
Yeah, perfect. No, that's good to know. And I know you've looked at exposure to sexual content within the family home. So what sort of things would this involve? And what do we know about the links between this and problematic sexual behaviour? I know we briefly talked about maybe walking in on your parents having sex, but is there other things in the family home to be mindful of as well?
Mm-hmm. So this one, based on what has been available in the literature, measures of family sexuality have looked at things like availability of pornography in the home, as well as, again, yeah, being exposed, you know, often accidentally to sexual content. Mm-hmm. They've also looked at things like nudity, co-bathing, co-sleeping. But with regard to those, it's really important to acknowledge that what's considered sexualized has really strong cultural and contextual components. So sure, things like nudity, co-sleeping, co-bathing are certainly not sexualized activities in many contexts, in many homes. So there is some research that suggests that all of those factors together in overall generally termed family sexuality is linked to PSB, but the research that specifically looks at sexual exposure in the home on its own is pretty limited. So we can't mm-hmm. confidently draw many conclusions on that front.
Excellent. No, that's good to know. And interesting there, you mentioned as well the difference, I suppose, it would vary, like you say, by country, cultural context around what is appropriate and what is not appropriate. And has there been much in the research around then different cultural contexts on this subject?
Certainly not that I've seen. Much of the research that I've read has been based in North America. The research kind of started coming about in the late 80s, early 90s. Sure. So not a very old area of research either.
Yeah.
So there,
yeah. And if, as well, I suppose you touched on it a little bit there, actually, there's still a lot of, as always in research, there's still a lot of question marks and things that, yeah, I feel like once your PhD's done, you'll still have other questions that come up, I'm sure.
Yeah, the questions are endless.
That's what a postdoc is for. So what do we know about the impact of violent sexual content compared to non-violent sexual content on children and teens?
So based on our study, we found that children exposed to violent sexual content had a higher likelihood of engaging in PSB than did children exposed to non-violent sexual content. However, the difference between the two wasn't significant, which just means that we can't confidently conclude that the likelihoods of engaging in PSV when exposed to violent versus nonviolent content are meaningfully different.
Wow, okay.
So if we want to get a better understanding of this, what we need to research is really specifically differentiating between nonviolent and violent content, mm-hmm. which isn't an easy thing to do because exposure is typically measured through self-report after the exposure has already happened.
And imagine that's a bit, I suppose that there would be some objective measures to say kind of violent versus non-violent, but I suppose it's quite a subjective scale as well, maybe in terms of what the viewer thinks is, and I suppose that'll be based on a number of different factors in terms of what they've previously been exposed to, of what they think is
absolutely
violent. So I'm probably creating more questions for you.
It's great.
And are there gender differences between, the different genders when it comes to problematic sexual behavior?
So we found generally in the literature that it seems to be the case that more girls tend to engage in PSB in the preschool years, whereas boys tend to be more likely to engage in PSB in adolescence. It's hard to know if this represents a true gender difference in PSB because typically boys and males are overrepresented in the research on adolescent harmful sexual behaviors. In our study, we actually found that likelihood of PSB after exposure was stronger among girls, which really just speaks to a need to conduct research in more representative samples to understand why generally gender differences might exist.
Interesting, because I was going to say, is there, I know you mentioned, I suppose you see it more in the kind of preschool age with females than you do with males. And is there anything in the research that speaks to why that might be?
Potentially, it could be things like socialization as we go into adolescence, what is viewed as appropriate, what can be sort of expressed more socially. So that's one potential explanation, but there could be many reasons.
Yeah, more research for you, you and the team to do. And in terms of thinking about seeing or maybe possibly viewing problematic sexual behavior at school or in that school context, how important is it for staff and schools to be aware of problematic sexual behavior?
It's very important for multiple reasons. So effective treatment for children with PSB really involves a community-based response, which means that all adults in a child's network are equipped to identify concerning behaviors when they see them so that kids and families can get the support that they need. And school staff might be particularly well situated to identify behaviors just by nature of the amount of time children spend at school with peers and other kids. And it's also important to be aware of PSB so that when it comes up, it's dealt with in a way that's most likely to lead to positive outcomes. So that's without stigmatizing or shaming a child who's engaging in these behaviors. And with that understanding that PSB can be really effectively addressed with the right referrals and the right treatments.
Perfect. That's a good message. And like you said, you know, you want to try and avoid a negative response and not to stigmatize or shame the child in any way. So if a staff were to notice or be made aware of problematic sexual behaviors at school, how can the child be best supported in that context? If a parent or a teacher sees behavior like this, how should they best respond?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's important, especially for parents and caregivers, just to acknowledge that becoming aware of these behaviors can bring up a lot of emotion. So you know, potentially feelings of embarrassment or guilt or shame. It can be isolating.
Yeah.
Ideally, a response is calm and non-judgmental to a child and to oneself as, you know, a parent or caregiver, and that it's a response that's supported by the community again. So this might mean working with a child's teacher to create a safety plan at school, working with other adults in a child's life to arrange supervision if that's available, monitoring devices to limit access to sexual content, and then importantly, reaching out to professional supports, whether that be child services or child advocacy centers, that can help to point to, you know, helpful resources or treatments.
Perfect. No, that's great. So quite a holistic approach then to making sure child is best supported. And as you say, I think the key there is not to, I suppose, monitor your own responses to that as well as, you know, responding to the child. So we're not creating more stigma or shame around this kind of topic, because it is really important. And I think I know we touched on it a little bit, but shame or stigmatization might lead to not addressing it properly or fully, or maybe addressing it but in a very negative way. So that's really important. So thank you for that answer. And we touched on it a wee bit at the start of our conversation, but How important is it, in your opinion, to have open, age-appropriate communication with children about sex and sexuality generally? And is there any research out there that we know about that having this age-appropriate communication can impact on reducing problematic sexual behaviour?
I mean, in my opinion, it's really important. What we know is that evidence-based treatments aimed at supporting children with PSV and their families explicitly include sections on sex and providing accurate information on things like puberty and sex. Mm-hmm. So we also know that sexual behavior is an exploration, curiosity about our bodies. These are a natural part of development. So providing open, supportive, accurate information can help to ensure that children's sexual behaviors throughout development are appropriate and are healthy.
Perfect. And do you know of, or is there any good resources that you might recommend or kind of advise that parents could maybe look at? Because I know that, I suppose, again, this is anecdotal based on friends that I have that have young children, but they often sometimes struggle to find the most age appropriate terms to use with their child, depending on the age of them. And obviously they don't want to overly sexualize a conversation or make it too biological. Or yeah, I think sometimes it's a bit of a murky water for parents. So is there any good resources that you know of that we could signpost to?
Definitely. So these are sort of more like PSB specific resources. Yes. But a really fantastic one is the National Center on the Sexual Behavior of Youth. Their website has extensive information and resources on problematic sexual behaviors, what they are, evidence-based treatments, as well as resources for both parents and professionals. And then also the website for the National Children's Alliance is a great place to go for information. They've published some really sort of succinct and helpful fact sheets on PSB.
Excellent. Well, that's good. That's really helpful. Thank you. And I can imagine it's likely difficult to talk to children about their experiences, either as someone behaving problematically or a child that has been impacted by problematic behavior of others. So do you have any advice on opening up those conversations with children on the subject?
So these conversations can be really difficult to have, both for adults and for children, as we've touched on already.
Sure.
Honest disclosures are more likely to happen if children are approached in a non-judgmental and a non-punitive way. So a lot of these behaviors are out of curiosity, they're out of impulsivity, and children don't often have a full understanding of what the implications of those actions might be. So, you know, if talking to a child who has behaved problematically, reassuring them that you're there to support them and keep them and other children safe can be helpful. And when talking to a child who may have been impacted by the sexual behaviors of another, you know, letting them know that you're glad they told you, or inquiring about who a trusted adult might be, who they would be, you know, feel safe and willing to talk to you about. These things can be ways to open up the conversation.
That's great. And I know, shameless plug, but we've got a good resource and tooled up. It's kind of like a five finger support thing. So children can kind of name trusted adults that they might go to speak to something if they're in trouble or if something's happened.
Fantastic. Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's good. And I think, again, I feel like teachers are probably in a super well-placed position to have those conversations with children, probably more than they realise, in terms of, like you say, they spend a lot of time with children during the week, and actually children probably might trust them or open up to them a little bit more. So, and in terms of, is there any advice that you could give to teachers then, if they're in that position and a child maybe does open up to them that something they have been victim to or have experienced problematic sexual behaviour, is there advice that you would give to a teacher at that point about what's the appropriate courses of action after that happens?
So yeah, again, you know, when a child might disclose information like that, again, to just be really calm in receiving that information. It can be helpful to envelope, again, a community within that conversation, not being the parents, but in a respectful way. And then if it's required that professional supports come in, sometimes it can be helpful to, you know, have a call together with the child's family to, say, child family services, so that it's a really collaborative process and that the resources can then be made available to a child's network as a whole, and it's kind of dealt with as a team.
Perfect. That's great. Thank you. And I know that you touched on there, when I was talking about age-appropriate communication, and you mentioned the two resources, the National Children's Alliance and the other national community that you mentioned, is there any other useful or helpful resources that you would like to point out to educators or parents that are maybe wanting to find out more? Or are those the kind of two main ones to go to?
Those are definitely ones that I reference really frequently, specifically with PSB. I'd be happy to send along maybe links to some additional ones that
Perfect.
Would be helpful, maybe just more about having, maybe not related to PSB specifically, but having those conversations just about sex and sexuality and emotion management, things that might be helpful.
Yeah, no, that would be perfect. Because I think even, not that it would be related to PSB, but I know that conversations that we sometimes have with schools when they're running lessons maybe around public health and sexual behaviours, sometimes teachers can be a bit uncomfortable about having conversations maybe about pornography or maybe about other kind of more abusive relationships or domestically abusive relationships that can be quite difficult to bring up sometimes. So actually any resources that you've got around those kind of things, I think would be really, really super helpful.
Definitely. There's one that actually comes to mind. It's Salima Noon. I was also looking at her website. She's a sexual educator and has a bunch of fantastic resources about like how to bring up various different conversations and sort of easy kind of infographics that relate to different conversations that might be, you know, of interest to parents or teachers wanting to broach this topic with the kids in their lives.
Excellent. No, I think that that's helpful. And as we've been saying, I think the more you can normalize those conversations or try and take the stigma or the embarrassment out, then the kind of better that is for either maybe someone broaching a topic with you if they've experienced PSB or they've seen something happen to someone else. Then I think, yeah, the more we can kind of have those open conversations, the better.
Absolutely.
Lovely. Thank you. And what exciting projects are you working on currently, and what would you like to see? I'm sure we've already covered a bunch of other questions, but what would you like to see in future research on this topic?
Mm-hmm. So currently I'm working on a paper that's looking at the characteristics and outcomes of an evidence-based treatment for PSB.
Okay.
So this was an intervention that took place at a Canadian Child and Advocacy Centre. And that's really exciting in terms of contributing to the evidence for PSB treatments that can really actively help children with PSB and their families. In terms of future research on this topic, it would be really helpful to get a clear measure of exposure to sexual content, as we chatted about. And this would just help us get a better understanding of the associations between different kinds of sexual content and children's problematic sexual behaviors. And as well, like I mentioned, research that tries to get at the mechanisms by which exposure and PSB are linked can help us understand not only why the two are associated, but also how they're associated, why that association exists. And maybe that information can help to refine how we talk to children about things like online safety, media literacy, and online sexual content.
Excellent. So you've got, sounds like a lot of work ahead. But yeah, what a fantastic area to be working in, and something that's so important. And it'll be great to hear, hopefully from you at some point in the future, how the treatment study went and hear the results from that, because hopefully that's a promising avenue. Excellent. Well, thank you so much, Camille. It's been a pleasure to talk to you about this really interesting field of research. Good luck with the rest of your research, and we'll hopefully be in touch soon to hear about more results in the future.
Thank you so much. It's such a pleasure to be here and to talk about this research.
Thank you.
This podcast is brought to you by Tooled Up Education, the home of evidence-based tips on parenting, family life, and education. www.tooledupeducation.com. Parents and teachers in Tooled Up schools can also access notes accompanying each podcast, available to read and download from the Tooled Up site.